I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, the stage is set. President Biden and former President Trump square off in their first 2024 debate tonight. We have a preview from Atlanta. Lots of questions. The Supreme Court releases a ruling on abortion in Idaho, why the case could return to the nation's highest court. In good standing, Mike Rowe tells us about his new movie and the role faith and the Bible played in the lives of important figures in American history. And a song in their hearts. A report from Wisconsin as the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage makes its way across the Midwest. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the Feast of St. Cyril of Alexandria. Our top story tonight, it is the Battle of Atlanta, one historic night with two contenders as President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump square off on stage. It has been 4 years since the two faced off, but this time is different. The first presidential debate of the 2024 election will be the first ever to feature one sitting president and one former president. And it's also the earliest general election debate ever. The stakes could not be higher for either candidate, and the voting public knows it. According to an AP Newark poll, roughly half of Democrats and Republicans say the debate is extremely or very important for the success of the candidate of their party's presidential campaign. 57% of the public say they are extremely or very likely to tune into at least some of the debate or the follow-up commentary about it. Just 37% of adults say they are highly likely to listen or to watch to the live debate. All right, we go now to Philip Crowther, international affiliate reporter with the Associated Press. He is in Atlanta at the so-called spin room, which is just across the way from the debate stage. Philip, always good to be with you. So how are things shaping up down there for tonight's debate?
Well, look, the truth is anything that is being said right now here in this spin room will be forgotten in a few hours' time. What you're seeing here is the surrogates slowly coming out here, both for President Joe Biden and for former President Donald Trump, trying to already spin what their performance might be like in this debate. As you mentioned, this is we're in a sports stadium here just across the road from the CNN studio where this debate will take place. And it will look and feel very different to the last time you saw these two men debate 4 years ago, and very different indeed to the time before when they debated, because that was when it all turned into a very chaotic debate indeed, with a huge amount of interruptions. That's why some of the rules that were established for this debate are so stringent. The most important one is that there is essentially a mute button. The person or the candidate who is not speaking, who is not asked to respond to a question from the two moderators, will not be heard. Their microphone will be muted while the other one is talking. Also, there won't be a live TV audience, maybe to make for a less raucous occasion, if you will. These were all demands, by the way, put in by the Biden campaign, and these were demands that the Trump campaign then did agree to. So no reason for anybody to complain, really, when it comes to the rules. It's going to be exactly 90 minutes long, two commercial breaks, during which, by the way, the two candidates are not allowed to have any kind of conversations with political advisors that might be traveling with them here to Atlanta.
Well, Philip, can you compare and contrast the way in which each of the candidates prepared for tonight?
Well, the truth is, I think that President Biden's preparations have been a little bit more diligent, at least according to the schedule that the White House has put out. We know that he's been at Camp David, the presidential retreat in Maryland, for days now, and that's where a mock setup of the debate stage was even set up. He had someone standing in, his personal lawyer, in fact, standing in for former President Trump in order to prepare as best he possibly could for these 90 minutes inside the CNN TV studio. Now, former President Trump has prepared as well, but in his own way, if you will, quite a few rallies, quite a few appearances with supporters. Of course, he's somebody who likes to say doesn't really need any preparation, that he'll be ready to go as soon as the show begins. But I think they both know how consequential this truly is. The general consensus is that if something goes particularly wrong for either candidate rather than goes particularly right, well, then those moments will be clipped into these small snippets that will live on social media and could have a real impact on who people might vote for in November. Now, there aren't many undecided voters out there, but there are those who don't like either candidate, and they might very well be looking in tonight and trying to find out who they maybe dislike the least.
Yeah, and we will be tuning in as well. Phil, thank you so much. Always appreciate it. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers are not only busy working on passing a number of funding bills, but many are also having their eyes towards tonight's presidential debate between former President Donald Trump and President Joe Biden. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales breaks down what lawmakers hope each candidate highlights.
Good evening, Tracy. Tonight's highly anticipated debate is the talk of Capitol Hill. Lawmakers on each side of the aisle are hoping their candidate makes the case to become the nation's 47th chief executive.
Everybody wants to know which Joe Biden's going to show up. And look, my summary is this. It doesn't matter if he drinks a whole gallon of energy drinks. He's not going to be able to match the acumen and the readiness of Donald Trump. And that's what we expect.
Others agree.
Yeah. I'd like to see the president talk about what he's going to do if elected and moving forward and not backwards. You know, he has a great record, both on economy. He stopped the confrontations you see around the world right now, peace through strength.
I am expecting President Biden to try to make this about some of the legal issues in New York and the court cases. And I expect President Trump to say, all he can focus on is me. I'm actually focused on you, the American people.
Meanwhile, Democrats tell me President Biden should highlight a number of his accomplishments.
The president can talk about how the fact that is our inflation rate is the lowest of any major industrialized country in the world. Our unemployment is the lowest it's been in 60 years.
Joe Biden has done an outstanding job, quite frankly, and I hope they will get a whiff of that. That they'll see it, they'll understand it, and they'll know the difference.
This debate, when the people have just that minute, when there's not the noise, there's not the interruptions, and there's just some clear-cut questions on the visions that these two candidates have going forward, there's going to be a clear difference on that stage.
The debate comes at a time when many Americans are seeking relief from high prices, intense national debate over access to abortion, and deep divides over immigration policy and reform, all of which I'm sure will be addressed tonight. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
All right, now to the Supreme Court, where the justices ruled that Idaho hospitals must perform abortions in emergencies. This after the ruling was briefly posted online yesterday. In the 6-3 ruling, the justices said the exceptions to Idaho's near-total ban are too narrow. Abortions are allowed only to save the life of the mother. The High Court says the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, also known as EMTALA, allows abortions when a woman is faced with other risks, such as a loss of fertility. The case now returns to the lower Ninth Circuit Court. And for more, let's go to Carrie Severino, president of the Judicial Crisis Network and a former law clerk for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Carrie, great to see you. First, your thoughts on the justices' ruling, which, as we said, was leaked yesterday but officially released today.
Yeah, well, first, it's important to realize that the justices didn't actually rule on the merits of this case yet. They have not officially weighed in on whether EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Act, overrides Idaho law. They simply said, we need to let this work all the way through the courts. And normally that would be what would happen. They kind of went out of their way to take this case. And now five justices said, on second thought, let's let it go back to the normal process. That's frustrating for everyone who put in a lot of time and effort to brief this case and to get up there. But the case has been a bit of a moving target, both because the Idaho law has changed somewhat in the pendency of the litigation and because the United States, in its arguments to the Supreme Court, made a lot of serious concessions. And that was ultimately what Justice Barrett said was dictated her decision that was joined by the Chief Justice and Justice Kavanaugh to send it back, let them take this case on up again, and see if, after the government agreed that, for example, conscience exceptions do have to be made to this law, you can't force doctors to do forced abortions, and that and that perhaps, you know, just for a woman's mental health, they can't force the hospital to have an abortion. maybe there'll be nothing left of this case after that's done. Maybe it will have to work its way back to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and jumping off of that a little bit, I mean, the ruling seems to provide really little legal clarity on emergency abortions. That said, do you think either side can really claim a victory on this decision?
Well, you know, if there's any victory, it's for the federal government, unfortunately, in the fact that the stay was lifted. I think, you know, it's a closer case whether the court should have taken it in this interim intermediate phase to begin with or whether they should have returned it to the Ninth Circuit, you know, on second thought as they did. But I was very disappointed that the court didn't at least keep the stay in place because before they at least had stayed the decision. They said it for the interim. There won't be any abortions provided in Idaho that don't meet the life of the mother exceptions that are present already in Idaho law. Now, though that opens the door, I think we'll have to see whether what happens with that, how many abortions are provided in the meantime. And unfortunately, I think it also opens the door to potential gaming of the system by hospitals or doctors who want to create a record that makes it seem that that those numbers of abortions are maybe higher than they actually are. Because it's actually a very narrow range that you can imagine of situations where a woman would experience long-term real health consequences, but also not be in a life-threatening situation.
Yeah, and Carrie, I mean, this is really the second case in about 2 weeks, I think, where there was cases related to abortion. Do you think, let's talk a little bit more about that, the Mifepristone case in this case, and do you think both of those will be headed back to the Supreme Court?
Well, this one, I think, very likely will. The Mifepristone case, unfortunately, probably won't because the court decided it on standing grounds. What they said is the people bringing this case, the doctors, the emergency room doctors in that case, aren't the right people to challenge this regulation. And at this point, it's hard to know whether the time frame has already elapsed to be able to find someone who could be the right party to challenge those Mifepristone regulations. You can imagine that a woman who, for example, had a serious health consequence or even had died in the family could sue on their behalf because of those lowered standards that unfortunately are now in place, opening the door to a lot of women receiving the drug in a way that's significantly less safe. So it's possible to imagine that coming back, but it would have to be a whole new case from scratch with different plaintiffs. And I'm not sure there's time following the regulation to bring that case.
All right, almost out of time here, but quickly, any final thoughts?
Yeah, you know, both of these are kind of discouraging for the pro-life movement, I think. But remember, they were decided on procedural grounds, so they're not sending forth a precedent that I think is going to be binding in future cases. They really were procedural things where this isn't the right case at the right time. Hopefully the court can clarify these questions going forward.
All right, Carrie, thank you so much for insights. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right, now to Wisconsin, where the state Supreme Court says an order barring a pro-lifer from coming close to an abortion business employee violated his First Amendment rights. In a unanimous ruling, the justices said the injunction must be dismissed because the pro-lifer's comments to a Planned Parenthood nurse were made from a public sidewalk. And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including Standing Invitation. Mike Rowe tells us all about his new film where he rediscovers the stories of those who built our nation.
Trip to our nation's capital, not too far from where I grew up,
to reacquaint myself with the memorials and monuments built to honor the people in this film.
Welcome back. That was part of the trailer for Something to Stand For, the new movie by Mike Rowe, best-selling author, producer, and TV host, best known for his Emmy award-winning show, Dirty Jobs. His latest project, Something to Stand For, takes viewers to the heart of the nation's capital with detours at the American Revolution, World War II, the Civil Rights Movement, and more. It is part history, part mystery, and is all about the people who built our great nation, and it hits movie theaters today. And joining us now to tell us more about it is Mike Rowe himself. Mike, great to be with you, and congratulations on the new movie. So what inspired you to make it, and why now?
Well, it's Independence Day, or at least it's right around the corner, and I've been writing these short stories for years now in the style of Paul Harvey, Remember the Rest of the Story, where listeners had a chance to learn something they didn't know about somebody they did, and then figure out along the way who Harvey was talking about. That model worked great on my podcast. The podcast turned into a book turned into a TV show, And then my friends over at Fathom Events called and said, look, our country seems confused about when to stand and when to kneel and what to feel good about and what to feel bad about. How about a straight up love letter to America, unapologetically patriotic? Do you have a few stories that would work? I said, yeah. They said, great. Poof. Movie.
Yeah, and it really is great. And it comes at a time when there's so much division in our country right now. Let's talk a little bit about that, Mike, and, you know, the decision to make this movie during this time.
Mm. Well, it seems to me that, like a lot of other things, patriotism got clouded up with politics. And that's a shame. I think it's fair to say patriotism is on the ropes in our country. Every Gallup survey out there says the same thing. Back in 1998, it was 71% of Americans who described themselves as extremely patriotic. Today, that number is more like 39%. So something's happening in our country that's making it very difficult for people to feel proud and to feel grateful and to celebrate all of the progress that we've made over the last 2.5 centuries. And I just wanted to do something to say, look, it's okay. You know, we were founded by imperfect people, and we're not done yet. We still have lots of work to do. But the amount of progress that we've made is extraordinary, and we owe it to ourselves to celebrate the good things about the USA. And there are many.
Yeah, and that's so important to do. I want to talk about the movie itself now. I know that you said, you know, you'll introduce people in American history that we should know more about. Tell us about some of those great Americans and why you chose the people you did.
It's a tricky question, Tracy, because so much of the movie is rooted in 9 surprises that I hate to give them away specifically. But I will tell you that you're not going to meet anybody you haven't already heard of. But you are going to learn, for instance, about a man who was challenged to a duel, pistols at dawn over a matter of honor, and who decided to reset the terms by saying, how about if we do it with broadswords in a pit? And the result of that barbaric idea led directly to the salvation of the country. And so when you tell a story like that from the inside out, hopefully you hook people along the way. And once you get their attention, then you can do some other things, which in my case was drive to our Capitol and visit the monuments and the memorials and the statuary that virtually every morning now need to be cleaned up by park rangers because they've been vandalized or defaced or covered with graffiti. So it's an interesting juxtaposition of how our present and how our future, I believe, are going to be tied directly to our ability to come together and celebrate parts of our past that are still worth celebrating.
And Mike, we're almost out of time, but I quickly want to touch on this. I understand that you also touch on the faith of some of the figures in the movie and how the Bible influenced them. What more can you tell us about that?
I can tell you that it's impossible to separate the men who formed this country from their belief system and their virtues and the way that that impacted just about every good thing that we enjoy today. The truth is, nobody wants a sermon. Nobody wants a lecture. Nobody really wants a history lesson. We want to be entertained first and foremost. So I try and do that in the film, but we don't pull any punches about who these people are, what they believed, and why. And we certainly don't apologize for it.
All right. And Mike, before I let you go, quickly tell folks where they can see the movie.
SomethingToStandFor.movie is the place to go. Enter your zip code and you'll figure out where it's playing. We're in about 900 theaters. You can also see the trailer over there and some fun behind-the-scenes stuff. SomethingToStandFor.movie.
Looking forward to it, and happy 4th of July. Thanks so much for coming on, Mike.
You too, Tracy. Appreciate it.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, back to school. Young professionals from around the world gather to learn what makes a faith-filled Catholic journalist. Plus, the faithful are inspired by the real presence of Jesus as the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage makes its way through Wisconsin. We have a report from our own Owen Jensen. Bolivia is reeling after an apparent coup attempt by a top general. The military leader vowed to restore democracy and stormed the government palace with soldiers and armored vehicles. The country's president appointed a new army commander who ordered the troops to stand down. More than a dozen people have been arrested, including the general who led the coup attempt. The South American country is dealing with months of political tension and an economic crisis. A new report says around 400,000 people formally left the Catholic Church in Germany last year. The number is down from a record high in 2022 when more than 522,000 people left the church. No reasons were given for the departures. Overall, there are around 20 million Catholics in Germany. Well, students and young professionals from around the world just finished a two-week project in Rome. The mission, to become faith-filled future Catholic journalists. EWTN Vatican Bureau Chief Andreas Tannhauser has more.
Striving to capture the essential. That is how Pope Francis described the task of journalists. And he made that statement in the beginning of this year in front of Vatican reporters. The Holy Father emphasized the importance of not sugarcoating tensions, but at the same time encouraged them to not create any unnecessary noise. And this is actually just one of the lessons learned by participants at the EWTN Summer Academy over the last 10 days. 40 journalists from more than 20 countries studied, collaborated on scripts, produced videos, and tested equipment, as well as took a deeper dive into video journalism. It happened all right here in Rome, in front of St. Peter's Basilica.
We come from all over the world. There are people coming from Iraq, from Asia, from Europe, from the United States. And then we all come here together for the same mission, which is we want to spread Christianity using the power of the media.
For the third time, young communicators and influencers were asked to apply for this summer program, which aims at forming the next generation of Catholic journalists. And before being accepted, participants had to complete a demanding application process. Only the best and most promising candidates were accepted.
It's been such a blessing meeting Catholics from all over the world who also love their faith, love the Lord, and are passionate about journalism. And the Summer Academy has brought us together. Hopefully, we'll be friends forever.
In step with the current developments of the media landscape, the Academy focused primarily on video journalism and digital communication. This acknowledged the ever-growing importance of fast-moving images and decreasing attention spans. The Academy not only provided practical courses on filming, video editing, and social media distribution, but also on theological knowledge and apologetics. In order to stand by their reporting, it is important for today's faith communicators to have the right arguments at hand when it comes to the Church's hot-button issues such as marriage and the right to life. The Summer Academy serves as the kickoff for the participants. They will now join their peers from previous years in a vibrant alumni community with regular meetings and continuous education. All of this will be instrumental to have a future generation of journalists that will be able to capture the essential. In Rome, Andreas Tannhauser, EWTN News Nightly.
And finally tonight, as we speak, step by step, mile by mile, the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage makes its way across the United States. The Holy Eucharist has been traversing several states and cities, bringing the faithful to their knees and often to tears of joy as they walk with Jesus. EWTN correspondent Owen Jensen caught up with the Holy Journey in one Midwestern state.
I'm here at St. Peter's Catholic Church in Kenosha, Wisconsin, the town I just happened to grow up in. It's the latest stop on this beautiful journey to Indianapolis. In Kenosha, halfway between Milwaukee and Chicago, the pilgrims arrive in the early evening with their precious cargo, the Blessed Sacrament, leading the way into church for a Eucharistic Holy Hour.
We sing holy, holy.
Outside St. Peter's, one young pilgrim walking the entire route, who once doubted the real presence, called the Holy Journey inspiring.
Wow, it's been such a blessing. Like, literally, I get to watch revival happening in front of me. And it's filled me with so much hope just to see the way that people are responding to the pilgrimage and responding to Jesus Christ.
And a local organizer told me the most moving thing that she's seen during the pilgrimage.
The number of different ways I've seen people come and pour out their love for God. That's the part where I get so emotional.
Earlier, we sat down with Bishop Donald Hying of Madison, Wisconsin. He says as the pilgrims make their way across the nation, he's absolutely grateful, joyful, and astonished.
Bishops along the routes have just uttered surprise at how many people have come out for processions, for masses, for confession, for adoration, but also service to the poor.
Bishop Hying told me linkage to the Eucharist is always going to lead us to the heart of those who are suffering. And for those who doubt the real presence, he acknowledges it takes an extraordinary amount of faith to believe in the Eucharist.
But I go to John chapter 6 and Jesus' beautiful discourse on the Eucharist. And in that chapter, he says something that I return to time and time again as really the source of hope. Because he makes this extraordinary promise that those who eat of his flesh and drink his blood will live forever. So the Eucharist for us is this great antidote to eternal death.
Meanwhile, the very next morning in Kenosha, the Eucharistic pilgrimage once again setting out for Indiana. Still a long way to go, but still time to join in as well.
As they make their way to the Hoosier State, if you see these pilgrims walking down a street near you, they'd love for you to join them and follow Jesus.
On this day, the faithful of all ages in this procession, including little ones, going along for the ride.
What does this mean to you?
The Eucharist is the body and blood of Jesus Christ. People who come to church can be receiving him to feed your soul.
How does this make you feel?
It gives me great pleasure and peace.
What does this mean to you, being a part of this?
Well, I think it means being a part of a community, being part of a family, exercising my faith, trying to show not just myself, but my family as well, that this is something that's important.
The Marian route we witnessed passing through southeast Wisconsin is just one of four pilgrimage routes that will conclude with a Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis just days from now. In Kenosha, Wisconsin, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.